So good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I thought it might be nice to start with a short sitting. But part of the reason for that, it seems like an appropriate way of segue into talking about the Dhammapada, these ancient teachings, these ancient words of the ancients. And I'm reminded of a story of a king who went one evening to visit the Buddha. And it was late at night, it was dark, and he was told that there was a large gathering of Buddhist monks in these woods where the Buddha was practicing, teaching. And so he went to the edge of that forest, and there he left behind his bodyguards and soldiers, and entered into the woods with his minister, and supposedly undefended, unusual for a mighty, somewhat horrible king, which he was. and he started walking into these woods, and after a short while he got really spooked, because it was completely still. Abnormally quiet, I guess, still in there. And he'd been told to expect a large gathering of monks around the Buddha in this grove of trees, and there was not a sound. And the discourses say that his hair stood on end because he was so afraid there was an ambush. But then his minister said, they saw a light in the distance, and so the minister led him into the light. And there, by the light, was the Buddha sitting. And then all around the Buddha were these group of monastics sitting and meditating, and sitting in silence, and perhaps waiting for the Buddha, for the Buddha's teachings to occur, the Buddha to teach. And this image of the Buddha sitting under a tree at night, outside in a grove of woods, in the woods, with people around that are sitting quietly meditating, for me is a very meaningful image, in that it's an image of simplicity, how little is needed, and how simple the Buddhist spiritual life can be, or the way it was taught. Not much is needed. There's not a lot of books. There's not a lot of rituals and stuff that needs to go with it. You can just go into the woods and sit at the foot of a tree, and there, with your own practice, realize the truth. So in that spirit and with that image, perhaps we can sit in silence, meditate for maybe 10 minutes, and then I'll discuss our text together. Good evening again, and many thanks for coming here to this book reading and signing. I never would have imagined so many people would have come. It wasn't it was inconceivable to me. And here there's so many people, and so I'm very kind of appreciative and gratified. It's very nice that you came and celebrate this book that I've It's been published. Yes? Trouble hearing? Yeah, but is it possible to turn it up a little bit? I should also speak up more. Is that better? Can you hear me now? So if it happens again, speak up, because sometimes my voice drops. So the Dhammapada is technically a book in the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism, the Buddhism of Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, little bit Bangladesh, teeny bit in India, you find a little bit in Nepal. It's a Buddhist tradition that kind of basically has survived in that part of the world for well over 2,000 years. And the Dhammapada belongs to that tradition. And it could be argued that it's the most loved book, loved sacred text of that tradition, of Buddhism. It is one of the first things that many monastics, monks and nuns, will study and learn when they enter into the monastic life. They'll often memorize verses from it and use it as part of their teaching, as part of their own practice. It is often, many of these verses of the Dhammapada then spread out from the monastic environment into the popular culture of many of these countries. And some of these verses are kind of cultural aphorisms or sayings that appear in many different forms those cultures and those countries. Many people know a lot of these verses. They recognize them. They grew up with them. It's kind of common currency, spiritual currency for many people. People go back and refer to this text for inspiration, for ideas. There's not any developed teachings in the text, but the teachings appear very short and succinct, and so they work very well as quotes and as references and as bases for Dharma talks and teachings. So it can be argued as maybe one of the most loved and best known of the body of sacred literature in the Theravada tradition, loved by both monastics and by lay people. It's often very accessible. Some of the other sacred texts, like the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, you know, it's a little bit difficult to get into it unless you've kind of somehow been initiated or familiar with the teachings. It's it easily put you to sleep to read some of that. But this is relatively accessible, Dhammapada, for many, many people. As Buddhism has come to the West, to Europe and to America, and to the Americas, it's Dhammapada sometimes is kind of seen as being the quintessential Buddhist sacred text. And it's kind of gone beyond the boundaries of its Theravadan tradition. And many people know about the Dhammapada and will think of it as kind of the sacred text of Buddhism or kind of as a reference for the practice. And I was first given a copy of Dhammapada by my first Zen teacher. So, you know, he thought it was very, very valuable and helpful, and he actually, it wasn't exactly, it was a personal gift to me, but I think he bought 100 copies, and he passed them out to all his students at the San Francisco Zen Center. The canonical or sacred literature of Buddhism is vast. It's amazingly vast. If you started today and was going to read it all, maybe you don't have enough lifetimes. I mean, it's unfathomably vast. However, the Theravada tradition that this Dhammapada is part of, it's a relatively manageable collection of only about 18,000 discourses. Some of them are quite short, but if you put them all together into English, you have maybe volumes that would maybe be this big on your shelf. So you can kind of manage it. But then if you get beyond the Theravada into the Mahayana, then the shelves, you know, get bigger and longer and longer, and it's just amazing how long they can be. And technically, there's no beginning to the Buddhist sacred literature in the way that there, would you say, there's a beginning to the Bible. The book of Genesis is the beginning. So there's no beginning per se. However, I've noticed that many people in the West will often take the beginning of the Dhammapada, the opening verses of the Dhammapada, as have the same function as the opening of Genesis. So it's kind of, if you want to look for a beginning, kind of conventionally, some people will take, this is the beginning, this is where it all starts, the Buddhist sacred literature, in this text, especially the first two verses. So I'd like to read you the first two verses, now that I've kind of built up perhaps a sense of importance that these verses have. The verses are difficult to translate, because of one word. And the word in Pali is a Dhamma, and which in English some of us know it as Dharma, Greg and Dharma. I think isn't that in the TV show? And as a Dharma. And Dharma has, turns out, has a lot of different meanings in Dhamma in Pali, in Sanskrit. And so the question is, which meaning of the one traditional dictionary gives, I think, 54 definitions for the word Dhamma. So which of those 54 definitions or other meanings should you translate the word Dhamma? And I've translated here as experience. It might be the most controversial thing I did in the whole book. So I'm hoping that people don't get to that second word in the translation and say, forget this book. though I do explain in a footnote why I chose this word and why I thought it was the best word. There are many other possible choices, but many of them are difficult, have difficulties in their own right. And so it's actually very difficult. Maybe it shouldn't have been translated at all. I translate it here as experience. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So here the emphasis is put on the creative power of the human mind, that somehow it all begins with the mind. It's led by the mind, made by the mind, preceded by mind. The mind is at the beginning. In the beginning, there was the mind. And whereas in the book of Genesis, it starts with God and the activities of God. And so it's quite, just very interesting to hold these two beginnings of next to each other and see that the context, the view of the religious life, the starting point, is very different in a theistic religion, perhaps, and then here in Buddhism, which in a sense, in a certain kind of unusual way, is considered atheistic religion. But here the mind is considered to be preeminent, very important. And what's saying here is that in using the word experience, experience is not the same thing as events. It doesn't say all events are preceded by mind. Experience, what I'm trying to say here, is that the way that we perceive are the events of life. The way we experience is through the medium of perception, interpretation, understanding, and the idea of that interface between the mind, creative ability of the mind to think and interpret, and the events of the world is what I'm calling here experience. And so that particular thing is somehow, the mind has a very, very important role in defining, interpreting, naming, shaping what our experience of the world is like. It says that about the mind, and then it gives a little kind of example. If you speak or act with a corrupted mind, suffering will follow, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Now the image of an ox pulling a cart with the wagon wheel is one of, you can maybe a little bit of imagination. It's really a burden. The ox is burdened by this heavy cart. It's struggling and pulling and sweating and snorting, and then it's pulling this cart, and the cart is heavy, and the wagon wheel of the cart follows because it's yoked, it's bound, it's tied up with the cart. It follows along. It's heavy work to bring this along. So speak or act with a corrupted mind, then suffering follows, and it's heavy. Suffering is a burden. It's something that keeps us entangled or entwined, yoked. And then it gives the example on the other end. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. And here, the image of a never departing shadow. A shadow has no weight. You know, no one's burdened by the shadow they bring along with them. It's just right there. It's light. It's, you know, it's not even, you can't even say it's light, right? Just the shadows have weight. And so it's something that's not a burden, doesn't interfere, doesn't hold us back, there's no drag. So happiness occurs to us in a very light, free, open way. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So here there's a dichotomy between what we do with our mind. Act with a corrupted mind, certain things follow. Act with a peaceful mind, and there's another thing that follows in the wake of that. So here, emphasis is placed on the mind, what we do with the mind, the creative potential of the mind, and suggesting that we start being the caretaker of the quality of our mind. And if we want to be careful with our mind, the kind of mind we speak from, the kind of mind we act from, and how we act and how we speak has consequences. And then the text wants to gives kind of some more examples of this. Quote, maybe some of you are better at acting this out, but he abused me, he attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. Oh no. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So here again, we have a verse that's quoted many, many times over and over again. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So here, hatred is a form of suffering, and it just, you know, the problems in our life, you know, if we live complaining and about life, complaining about things, then our hatred doesn't end. But if we can learn just to refrain from hating, to have a certain equanimity and peace and a certain kind of patience, a certain kind of forbearance, then hatred can come to an end, is what the suggestion here is. So here again, it's watching our own mind, watching our reactions, trying to live in a way, taking responsibility for the quality of our mind, which is emphasized here. And this you see throughout the text, the emphasis on taking responsibility for our own mind. There's a lot of discussion about training the mind, restraining the mind, calming the mind, making the mind peaceful. Just like a carpenter straightens wood, an irrigator straightens out the irrigation channels, and a fletcher straightens the arrows. Fletcher's an arrow maker. So a sage, a wise person, straightens her mind. So it makes it straight. So you have to do something. You take responsibility for your mind. You don't leave the state of your mind to chance, but you engage in it. And what you see through the text, what the text then presents, is an uncompromising teaching of personal self-reliance. Uncompromising teaching of taking self-reliance, self-responsibility, and personal liberation, becoming liberated. And I know of no other sacred text in the history of humanity that has the same kind of dramatic emphasis on self-reliance. The Theravadin tradition, out of which this tradition comes from, is sometimes criticized for teaching a spiritual path which is selfish by the other people who don't follow this tradition. And I don't think it's a selfish tradition at all, but this kind of emphasis on personal self-reliance maybe can be seen then. Personal liberation kind of be seen as, oh, you're so caught up in your own practice and your own mind and what's going on. The image the tradition gives that in response to this is that of two people who are stuck in quicksand. And if one of them, out of great compassion, tries to pull the other one out, the one doing the pulling is going to sink further into the quicksand. And then the other one tries to pull, and it's like a seesaw, they both go sink. One of them has to get up onto the dry land, and then from the dry land, it can pull the others out. So there's something to be said about, you know, getting out of the quicksand. Something to be said about, as you say in the airlines, you know, put the air mask on yourself first before you put it on the children, because, you know, otherwise you can't maybe get a chance to. So there's something to be said about taking care of oneself and being responsible for oneself and purifying oneself to some degree, so we can be a greater help to the world around us. So here, this text puts a lot of emphasis on personal practice. To get a little bit of sense of the sense of urgency that the text puts on this, the next quote goes like this, next verse. Many do not realize that we here must die. Well, I guess you all realize that, don't you?
Yeah.
But do you really realize that? Really realize that? Some of you, you know, people with gray hair are nodding. And but I've known plenty of people, including myself, for whom I knew I was going to die. It was a pretty clear thing. But it just seemed like kind of, it was there in the mythic future. And it didn't really have any impact on my life and how I lived my life and what I was doing. And I've known people who have encountered death in a very dramatic way because of some diagnosis or a friend who dies or, you know, something. And they realize, wait a minute. And they develop a sense of spiritual urgency that this is, you know, you don't know how much time you have. And let's get serious here about this life of ours. And you know, there's a lot of ways in which we can live our life in complacent ways or lazy ways or kind of postponing ways, procrastinating. So here is a very emphatic statement. Many do not realize we here must die. The way I read this text, the way I understand it as I read it, is that whoever brought these verses together had a sense of urgency, had a sense of human life is quite precious, the time we have is precious, and let's just get really down to what's essential right away. Let's get to the point. And let's not, you know, get sidetracked from some really important work that can be done. And so you find a verse here, the same chapter. It's a little bit funny verse, but those who consider the inessential to be essential and see the essential as inessential don't reach the essential, living in the field of wrong intention. Those who know the essential to be essential and the inessential as inessential reach the essential, living in the field of right intention. So to know what's essential and what's, you know, what's the deepest intention of our hearts, what's the most important thing to do with a human life, is the question that I see when I read this text here. Because that text challenges me as I read it. In the first chapter, as it talks about the importance of the mind and caretaking the mind, cultivating the mind, living with a mind that's pure or peaceful rather than one that's corrupted, it talks over and over again that the benefits of a peaceful mind or a purified mind is happiness either in this life or happiness in future lives. The results, the consequences of a corrupted mind, a hateful mind, for example, is unhappiness in this lifetime and unhappiness in future lifetimes. Until you get to the last two verses of the chapter. One who recites many teachings. So this, I pay attention to this, right? One who recites many teachings, but being negligent, doesn't act accordingly, like a cowherd counting others' cows, does not attain the benefit of the contemplative life, of the spiritual life. Have you counted other people's cows? One who recites but a few teachings, yet lives according to the Dharma, abandoning passion, ill will, and delusion, aware and with mind well freed, not clinging in this life or the next, attains the benefits of the contemplative life. So here the shift has been from attaining happiness in this life and future lives to beginning to talk about a whole different goal of the spiritual life, which is liberation, freedom. The benefits of contemplative life is meant to be the benefits of liberation itself. Freedom from, here it says, passion, ill will, and delusion. Aware and with mind well freed. And that little expression, aware and with mind well freed, I love that. It speaks something really precious, something really beautiful, a tremendous jewel, this invisible jewel that we all have, the capacity of the mind to be awake, aware, and freed. A mind that's freed doesn't have any preoccupations, it doesn't have any constrictions, it's not driven by fear, it's not driven by hate, it's not driven by ambition, confusion. Some of the mind has been freed and awake and aware. And this is the kind of the goal, which is called the ultimate goal or the absolute goal. The goal of happiness in this life is considered a conventional goal. And it's nice to have that, but it's not what the Buddha was really pointing to. He taught a path. He taught how to cultivate conventional happiness in life. But what he was really interested in was how to liberate the mind or the heart, how to free it. That freedom of mind, the mind that's aware and well-freed, awake and well-freed, is sometimes referred to or connected to what is called the deathless state, the deathless dimension. And maybe it seems like a strange expression, the deathless, many of us. In my own mind, I think it's an inadequate connection to the word deathless. It's kind of diminishes a little bit. But to get a little flavor of the deathless, I like the English expression, the timeless. If some of you have ever been present in such a way you felt that the moment was timeless, the deathless maybe has a little bit of that quality of the timeless presence. Vigilance is the path to the deathless. Negligence, the path to death. The vigilant do not die. The negligent are as if already dead. Now, so when I read this, I read a very powerful verse. Some people translate appamada as heedfulness, some people as diligence, some people as mindfulness, constant mindfulness, energetic mindfulness. I translate it as vigilance. Vigilance is the path to the deathless. Negligence is the path to death. The vigilant do not die. That's quite a promise. The negligent are as if already dead, or the mindless are as already dead. If you really want to feel life or be alive, you need to be awake and aware. If you're lost in your thoughts and hardly even know, have you ever gone driving in your car and realized two exits beyond that you missed your exit? Were you alive then? Where were you? And this sense of urgency in the text also translates to emphasis on energetic effort, vigilant effort, making really, there's nothing here about take your time, relax, just accept the present moment, everything will be fine, everything is perfect. These people are serious people. This is a serious teaching. Get serious and apply yourself, because who knows when you'll have the chance again. So they use a lot of words, like energetic words, effort, vigilance, energy appear over and over again. Absorbed in meditation, persevering, always steadfast, The wise touch nirvana, the ultimate rest from toil. And that's an interesting juxtaposition. You know, there's emphasis here on persevering, always steadfast. That's the path. And what that leads to is the ultimate rest from toil, from the work, from the efforts. So there's a contrast between the work of being on the path and then the results of that work, which is, here it's called a rest from toil, but which is a phenomenal experience of peace, of well-being. One of the flavors for me as I read this text that comes through regularly is that idea of peace. Having a heart, having a being that's deeply at peace, at rest, not in conflict with anything in the world. Now, since the mind is so important in all this, it's important to understand something about the mind. Restless, agitated, the restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control, the sage makes straight as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. Like a fish out of water thrown on dry ground, this mind trashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. You ever feel your mind is trashing about like a fish out of water? Yeah? Trying to escape Mara's command. Mara is the personification of all the forces of the mind which deaden the mind, which somehow bring about suffering, torment the mind. There's a beautiful book recently published called Destructive Emotions. That book is all about Mara. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. Some of the verses in the text, as you listen to them, don't have to be Buddhist. In fact, scholars believe that some of the verses in Dhammapada originated outside of Buddhism. They were kind of current at the time of the Buddha, or preceded the Buddha even in India. They were maybe part of poems that already existed or songs that existed at the time, and that they were taken by the Buddha or by early Buddhists and incorporated into the Buddhist texts. And so you listen to some of these, and some of these are just, you know, wisdom teachings that any spiritual tradition might speak. Here's one. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. That's quite a statement about the power of your own mind. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. Here's another wisdom teaching. Do not many traditions say almost the same thing. Do not consider the faults of others or what they have or haven't done. Consider rather what you yourself have or haven't done. Some of you know that I have a lot of favorite verses in here, but one of them is the one that goes something like, I don't know where it is right now, but something like, they'll criticize you if you speak a lot. They'll criticize you if you don't speak at all. And they'll criticize you if you speak in moderation. There's no one who's free from criticism. Now, I read that and I start feeling more equanimous very quickly. you know, what can you do? You do the best you can and you'll get criticized, and that's the way it goes. Irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood. Sages tame themselves. As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise or blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. For a person who, like the earth, is untroubled, who is well practiced, who is like a pillar of Indra, who is like a lake without mud, there is no more wandering. A pillar of Indra was a huge pillar that they bury at the entrance of a city, and it buried, you know, as much of it buried underground as above ground, so it was really tall, and so you couldn't move it. It was really unshakable. So that kind of stability and grounding and rootedness was someone who's liberated. But here's a nice one. I like this one, of describing an enlightened person. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who do not hoard, who are judicious with their food, and whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who have destroyed their toxins, their destructive emotions, and whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. So there's something untraceable about an enlightened person. You can't find their path. You can't find, there's something you can't be seen about them. And their field, the field they abide in, the dimension they live in, is somehow characterized, a certain kind of freedom that's characterized by emptiness and signlessness. It's a whole teaching in itself what that means, but